The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member at TNTRadio.live. Using science to debunk myths, from the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Sky Dragon Slaying. We're so lucky to have with us a climate expert, an author who contributed to the first UN IPCC report, Professor Arthur Vitorito from the College of Southern Maryland, USA. He knows his stuff. He's got a novel theory. He says climate science is not settled. It's changing all the time. And in the first hour, we were looking at his theory, geothermal forcing. And one of the things that struck me, Arthur, in the last year or so, reports are coming out that our ideas about the Earth's core are changing rapidly, aren't they? And the Earth is believed to have two cores now. And a lot of scientists are thinking that this is going to be changing our climate. What we do know for a fact is 3,200 miles below our feet, there's a semi-solid core, and that could be doing many things to change our climate. We know about geothermal forces through things like volcanoes. We know things about, one of the greatest stories I liked is that we can use geothermal heating, hydro vents, things like Yellowstone Park is a wonderful source of energy. But the climate scientists at the UN, they don't want to factor that in. It's a changing narrative in the real world of science, the truth of movement. We like to get the story out there. Arthur, you don't have a dog in the fight. You know, you're like us looking for truth. And, the idea that we are only changing climate by CO2 human emissions is pure bunkum, isn't it, Art?
Oh, I agree. The whole CO2 argument is it's so specious on its face. For example, if we look at, and in fact, I just sent this material to Jill Olson today. If you look at the rate of change in CO2, you see that the rate of change in CO2 almost exactly matches the rate of change in temperature, which almost exactly matches the rate of change in geothermal heating with a two-year lag. In other words, CO2, and a shorter-term study has been done by a number of Greek scientists that looked at the lag effects between warming, these super El Niños that we've experienced, and the release of CO2. And they found about a 6-month lag. The temperature increases first, and the CO2 jumps up six months to 12 months later. What that says is that we have a case of what we call Granger causality. It's an interesting concept. It's a chicken and egg problem. In other words, is the change in temperature causing the CO2 to increase, or is the increase in CO2 causing the temperature change? And this clearly shows that the temperature changes first and the CO2 levels change afterwards. So it's sort of like the, speaking of a chicken and egg problem, does the rooster crow because the sun rises, or does the sun rise because the rooster has crowed? We all know the rooster has crowed because the sun is rising. In this case, we know that the CO2 is increasing because the global and ocean temperatures are increasing, not the other way around. And we see this throughout the historical record too. We have excellent paleo records showing that over time, the globe has changed dramatically, both in terms of its temperature and its CO2. And we find that there's practically zero correlation between CO2 and global temperatures. It's a joke. If we look at, if you want to say, okay, let's look at the greenhouse gas loadings, CO2, anthropogenic CO2, the human component to carbon dioxide, is about 1% of all of what is considered to be quote-unquote greenhouse gases. By far, the most dominant greenhouse gas in the equation is water vapor. And we can't touch water vapor in terms of its quantity and in terms of its ability to absorb radiant heat. So the CO2 contribution to this, as I said, the human contribution is about 1%. To sit there and say that that's the quote-unquote control knob, which is the argument that they use, is, in my opinion, on the face of it, it's just absurd.
Yeah, another thing that I like to... Sorry, can I just make one more point, but a simple point for non-scientists? It's long been known, quite a while now, that it's been established that the surface of the sun is the same temperature as the core of the Earth, you know, 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Is that, you know, it's something that people should take on board, really, isn't it? It's something that we don't really factor in.
No, it's true. We really don't. And as we said, people look at, because there's a thin crust that insulates us from that, but we have these leaks at these mid-ocean ridges where the material and the temperature comes up rather rapidly. What I call this the fallacy of the means. The fallacy of the means, I used to use this as an example. If you were to plot what's called the population center of all the people living in and around the Gulf of Mexico, you would come up with a mean latitude and longitude for the average person living in the states of Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida. And the average place for a person to sit is the middle of the Gulf of Mexico. So the means are absolutely useless on this. What you have to look at is where the hot spots are, and the hot spots occur in the middle of the ocean. So this is very, very important stuff. Yeah, these black smokers have temperatures of up over 700 degrees Fahrenheit. You get tremendous amounts of heat. Plus the flanks of these ridges, which are 60,000 kilometers long, they are the main emitters of this heat. Most of that flux come off the flanks. So we're talking through a myriad of cracks and fissures in the system. So we have very, very large areas that are venting this geothermal heat. And yes, this is clearly stirring up the bottom of the thermohaline circulation. I think it's a no-brainer.
Mm. Yeah. Let me factor in the idea now of cosmic rays. Joe Possmer, you as a space scientist, you know, you're looking at it from the other angle, aren't you? You're looking at it from a cosmic angle, and while Art's looking at it from the Earth's angle. And speaking as an expert on the cosmic side of things, you know, what do you think about the cosmic rays situation? Do you think there's a lot of credibility in that?
Yeah, I think that must be a second order effect. Obviously, the first order effect of the climate is the sun heating it and creating it directly. Then there's second order effects. You know, we know about the solar cycle, the 11-year solar cycle, and there's longer term solar cycles, and that probably seems to be on the order, or it's totally connected to what Arthur is pointing out with the geothermal heating and the magma rates and the rate at which that is affecting the thermohaline circulation. Absolutely. And yeah, that does come down to an astronomical problem. Our solar system as a whole, after all, is moving through a galaxy. Our galaxy has, spiral arms full of gas and dust. It's a galaxy is very clumpy and very dirty, and there's lots of dust and there's lots of variable magnetic fields. That's why I was wondering if perhaps it was a change in our position in the galactic arm, perhaps a slight change in the magnetic field we're moving through of the galaxy that therefore has an effect on Earth's pole that's going to affect perhaps how Earth's magnetic pole moves or which direction it points. So yeah, there's really profound, really large scale effects to look at there. They're going to be long term. They're going to be, decadal or hundreds of years or thousands of years effects, certainly. But certainly there's some short term ones cosmic rays are going to have an effect. And certainly we know, I think it's pretty well established now that when the sun is active and it's blowing these huge explosions off its surface, these huge flares, it seems to clear out the local the local area where Earth is sitting, where the solar system is sitting, and we do seem to get good weather after the Earth. Within a year or so, it seems to be we get really good weather after the sun goes through these extreme explosive events. So definitely it seems like the sun is affecting, the local interstellar conditions of the solar system as a whole. And cosmic rays, are a part of that environment, certainly.
So was wondering for a very long time, since I took geology in 1969, why the magnetic field not only move, but the North Pole rotates around also. And so one of the articles that I came across when it was first published is researchers confirmed discovery of Earth's inner innermost core. This is a paper that was printed March of 2008 by geologists at Champaign, Illinois, studying seismic echoes going all the way through the center of the Earth. They determined that the inner core is 900 miles in diameter and that it is a cubic iron crystal. Well, iron is diatomic, which means it automatically has a magnetic dipole. And in order to be a crystal, it is a giant permanent magnet. And in addition, it rotates faster than the surface of the Earth. And when it rotates, it produces the magnetic field, which is our magnetosphere, as well as producing a whole lot of static electricity that flows up through the core of the Earth. And so, bottom line, I wrote an article on this after I attended the fake debate between Richard Lindzen and Gary North at the Houston Petroleum Club in January of 2010. The article is "No Loophole for Your Soul," where I discuss this. And after I wrote that article, I discovered more about the electric universe. And those guys say that it is electromagnetic currents that are flowing through the solar system that are driving that magnetic core. And so bottom line is, those are another fluctuating force that we have no monitoring on, and there's no proxy data for what those were in the past, because those are transient signals, just like cosmic rays. They don't leave signals where you can go back and create fake things, just like the hockey stick, which, by the way, is 100% totally fake. I read a book by Andrew Mumford called The Hockey Stick Illusion. And Michael Mann was able to make the little, the medieval warming period completely disappear so that he had the straight stick that he needed for his hockey stick CO2 curve by using three bristlecone pine trees and using the tree rings. And what Mumford proved in his book was that actually temperature is not the major factor in tree ring growth. The major factor is precipitation. The second factor is the grazing and disease and predation by insects. And then the third thing is temperature. So that's number one. And number two, for temperature, tree ring growth has a maximum and it's a bell curve. So if you, what you want to do is, if you don't know what the bell curve top is, you know, you got the two sides of the bell curve. You can make it warmer or hotter, I mean, cooler, deciding which side of the bell curve you want to pick as the data point for the tree ring width. And then recently I've come across another article on tree ring data, which just completely blows it away even further. It said that the other factors are the orientation as far as the direction, north, south, east, and west of the facing of the tree ring forest. And the other one is the altitude. So you've got all these variable factors. So you can't just take tree ring data and say, well, the tree rings are wider, therefore it was hotter. Absolutely absurd hypothesis. And that's why the guy will never debate anybody.
Dendroclimatology, as it's called, is a very interesting field with, yes, it's, there are lots and lots of pitfalls in interpreting that data. Joe, you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah, one of the things we like to emphasize is the importance of the scientific method. Using proxy data, we think, is a very, very poor way of doing science, especially when you're looking at something as, we do feel that climate science is an infant science. You know, climate science departments, faculties of science, climate science, haven't been around very long, less than 30 years. We know the first UN climate report came out in 1992, and right from the beginning, they already pinpointed the problem as CO2. They fixed the science from the beginning, and everything around for the last five or six reports has actually talked about CO2 as the driver of climate. And we're learning all through every year, every few years, the science moves on. We didn't know then back then about cosmic rays. We didn't know then about the changes in the inner core of the Earth. There are so many new things evolving that make us feel that we've got it wrong. I mean, the whole idea of the greenhouse gas theory was trumpeted back in the 1970s by Carl Sagan, and James Hansen jumped on the bandwagon, and Venus was used as the archetypal idea of what can happen with a runaway greenhouse effect. And we got that science wrong, didn't we? We had to use the Voyager probes to realize that Venus doesn't work the way we think it worked. So the idea that CO2 it traps heat and causes warming is a nonsense. And we've been able to prove that over the last 13 years at Principia Scientific. And people like you coming up with new theories, adding to the body of knowledge, again, is moving the goalposts again away from the nonsensical belief that human emissions of CO2 in any way, shape or form can alter the climate significantly or even measurably. And we have to give a shout out to a dear old friend, Dr. Pierre Latour, who once worked for NASA and had a wonderful career at DuPont. He proved there were four different ways that CO2 cools the planet, not warms the planet. So again, you're coming out with ideas that are going to have a lot of problems getting traction. And we're going to talk about some of those problems after the break. This is TNT Radio.
You should hear what Dirk Pohlmann is talking about.
The analysis in the United States was that Africa is going to be the next part on the planet, the continent, which will have two-digit growth, economic growth rates. And it's quite clear that Africa will follow. There's a lot of opportunity there. So the Americans declared that there will be a new command, the Africa Command. And they wanted to place the Africa Command somewhere in Africa. None of the countries was willing to host Africa Command. So Africa Command is now, it's in Germany. It's in Stuttgart, Germany. So Africa is run from Germany because the United States does not have to ask what they're doing in Germany. And this leads to the other thing that you mentioned, that our country is in effect still an occupied country from World War II with a limited sovereignty, you could call it, for the interior. Many things can be done, but not everything. And for the exterior policy, we have to swallow that the Americans blow up the Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea. And we have to look eagerly to Russia if they were the culprit to do that.
The Dirk Pohlmann Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Support childhood slavery and buy an electric vehicle. We mandate that the truth be told. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, welcome back, Sky Dragon Slaying. We're talking to one of the original authors of the UN IPCC climate report back in the day. The IPCC was set up in 1988 by the World Meteorological Organization and the UN Environmental Programme, that's UNEP, and their job was to provide policymakers with regular assessments of the scientific basis of climate change. That was the stated goal, but reality is quite different. The idea then was to justify a tax-raising agenda blaming human emissions of CO2 for climate change. Art Vittoretto, you were there at the beginning. You fell foul of the gatekeepers in the end, didn't you? You started saying things they didn't like. You were kind of pointing the finger away from CO2, and you were an outcast. And you're getting it again with your new theory. You're over there with the Heartland Institute. You're on the panel there. How are they taking to your new theory with your geothermal heating?
That's an interesting question. There is support for it, but there's also some rather violent opposition to it. Even within Heartland, there are folks who do not like what I am talking about. I seem to be getting in a lot of people's ways and stepping on a lot of toes. Just as a bit of a background on this, the first paper I published on this back in 2016, I sent to 9 different publications, and I was flat out rejected by 5 of them. 4 of them wouldn't even send it out for review. They said, no, this doesn't work for us. This isn't good. One says there's absolutely no quality to this paper. One said that, don't you realize that CO2 is what's causing the globe to warm? So there's been some violent opposition to this. And so yes, publishing in this in a new paradigm is very, very difficult. It upsets a lot of apple carts. Charles Darwin, for example, knew that when he wrote his theory of evolution, he said, I'm not out there trying to convince today's group of scientists. I'm writing for the next generation of scientists because I know it will not change their minds. What's the old saying that they laughed at Fulton, that steam engines were laughed at? One of my geophysical heroes is Alfred Wegener, who was a meteorologist, trained as a meteorologist, and ended up making his biggest contribution to the field of geology. He came up with the theory of, at the time, was called continental drift, which today we have sort of recast as plate tectonics. Wegener was a brilliant scientist. He was one of the most determined scientists you'd ever want to see. And he died doing some mapping of Greenland and setting up meteorological stations in Greenland. And he was thoroughly disgraced and thoroughly shunned from his field after he came out with the drifting of continents. He never got a teaching or research position after that. He was a complete outcast. And we see this happening all up and down the line. Stephen Jay Gould, another giant in paleontology, called academia a viper's pit. It's dog eat dog. It's people fighting for power, prestige, and grant money. So getting these things to work and getting some traction with these things is very, very difficult. But Heartland has been very supportive of my work. As I said, there are a few folks at Heartland that have not been supportive of my work. And you just have to keep plugging away at it. In fact, just today I had some... shall we say, some rather vigorous email exchanges with one of the Heartland advisors who doesn't like my stuff, and he keeps throwing up what I would consider to be specious arguments as to what's wrong. Well, you didn't use the right data catalog to prove this. And I said, well, I know you've made this point. I switched the data catalog to one that has what's called magnitude of completeness. That is, the catalog is complete for the number of earthquakes. And I got the exact same answer. Slight variations in it, but we have a complete catalog. In other words, I've sampled the entire population of earthquakes of a magnitude 5.3 and greater, and we get the exact same result. But yet he keeps insisting that, well, I spoke to an expert, and they suggest that you use this database. And it's like, well, I went to the literature, and they suggest I use this other database. But he continues to harp on this. He continues to denigrate my work. And this is how the game gets played. Sometimes you feel like Sisyphus, you know, rolling the rock up the hill, and then it just keeps rolling back on you. But I've just got to keep plugging away. I've got a reanalysis of that data coming out now, which shows a very, very strong correlation, which shows a very tight match between the global temperature trend since the late 1970s right up until the present. It shows in great detail the cycling of El Niños and La Niñas. It's very, very tuned into that. It has a 2-year lag, and the fit, the goodness of fit, as we say in statistics, is very, very good. In fact, I'm explaining about 55% of the variation in global temperatures just with the global seismic activity, which, of course, you're right, it's a poor indicator, but it is a good proxy for how much geothermal heat comes up. The correlation is practically 1 for the amount of seismic activity you have and the amount of geothermal heat comes up from the ocean floor. So we just have to keep plugging away at this. Eventually, I have gotten other people interested in this. There are new avenues to explore in terms of the research. And I think there are new new ways and new means to get this word out there. I'm considering starting my own website and posting this data on a regular basis. And eventually, I think people will start to see this. I think more and more people are receptive to the idea. I think the tide's going to shift.
Yeah, you've got to.
I'm glad you mentioned proxies, because I have a real issue with a whole bunch of the proxy data that they extrapolate from, including carbon 14, ice cores, isotopes. And I wrote an article at Canada Free Press about this in November of 2010 called Amazing New Roncos Proxy Croc. And let me just read the first little part of this satire. Perhaps you're one of those traditional scientists stuck in the lab, gathering data the old-fashioned way, envious of those high-flying climatologists, the ones who seem to cook their numbers with such ease. While they earn green beatification, you sit green with envy, wishing you had success. Well, wish no more. With the amazing new Ronco Proxy Croc, you too can cook your numbers with ease. It's a great little article. Highly recommend it. And I go into a whole bunch of detail that, and then a following article called Proxy Croc Memo on why fresh killed seals and penguins in Antarctica have a carbon dating of 3,000 years old, why almost everything in the ocean has a carbon 14 dating of 400 years old. I can explain it, but they can't explain it.
Yeah, let's use a famous quote by Max Planck in 1950. He said, a new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. And that's fair, isn't it, Art? I mean, the way it works out, it's a slow grind. And we've been doing this stuff at Principia Scientific for 13 years, trying to show the world that CO2 actually is plant food. It's not the control knob, and it actually cools the planet and not warms. And we've had applied scientists, thousands of applied scientists, confirm the fact that in industry, CO2 is used as a cooling gas. And there's nothing that we can see that can make it turn into a warming gas in the atmosphere. And, you know, we're with you, Art. We're shoulder to shoulder with you, brother. We're trying to persuade the doubters. A lot of it is vested interest. A lot of people's careers have been staked on their own arguments. I mean, we look at the lukewarmers, we look at the people like Richard Lindzen, people like that, who've done very, very well. They're icons in the movement for lukewarmers. But we don't agree with them, and because they always say there's got to be some warming from CO2. We can't see it, and they don't explain it very well. Joe Posma, I mean, you've tried for years, haven't you? You've had nothing but pushback, denial of journals offering to publish your work. Where do we go from here? You know, yourself and Art with novel ideas. Where do you see it going from here?
Well, yeah, it really was a good point that Art was bringing up earlier about these people that you deal with who seem to be gatekeepers. You know, there seem to be fifth column operatives inside every single movement that's trying to bring rationalism to the climate debate, and they do whatever they can to stop the debate from moving forward and from good information, new perspectives from being considered. It's something we've dealt with forever. I've dealt with personally recently, basically on a constant basis dealing with this. You're trying to just talk about the most simple things. Like, for example, look, if you do the flat earth average sunshine is cold. If you use a round earth, sunshine is hot, because the math works out different. And then it's just like, they just won't have the conversation. It's like, why can't you have that conversation? It's so basic. We're just talking about what sunshine actually does, the actual real-time flux. It's actually hot, it's not cold. And they will just do whatever they can to stop that conversation and that knowledge from moving forward and being spread. It's just the oddest thing. So yeah, I do believe we're just all faced with this sort of fifth column operative force. But John, you made such an excellent point earlier when you pointed out that climate science is a new field. You know, if you consider physics, geology, astronomy, these are natural fields that, naturally come up as topics of scientific curiosity because we're faced with these things, you know. Traditionally, climate science would have been part of geology. But now, you're right, climate science is a new field. But the thing about it is that it is a new field with political consequences. You know, it's not just a simple, innocent new field of people innocently doing science because it's curious. This is absolutely a field of political consequences. So it is not a traditional science. It hasn't been set up as a traditional science in any way, has it?
Now, let's give a shout out to our dear departed friend, Dr. Tim Ball, who, you know, he passed away last year at the age of 82, I believe. He fought the climate art debate from the 1980s. He graduated with a PhD from Queen Mary College, University of London. And he argued that what we're doing is fighting in a field that's so many unknowns. And he said the real enemy here is post-normal science. And post-normal science is developed in the 1990s by Silvio Pontowitz and Jerome R. Ravitz. And they said that it's a problem-solving strategy appropriate when facts are uncertain, values in dispute, stakes high, and decisions urgent. And that's the key point here, decisions urgent. You create a crisis and you use the scare tactics. Did the same thing with the pandemic, didn't they? They made the point that we're facing a virus that's going to infect the whole world. We had to act quickly. We had to take a chance. And you've got some computer modeler guy called Professor... what's his name? Oh, in London, at the Imperial College. He was saying that a million people would die. And again, the computer models are swaying policymakers. And it's GIGO, isn't it? Garbage in, garbage out. Neil Ferguson, Professor Neil Ferguson, name came back to me. This is the problem. And post-normal science is when they can play with their computer models and rig the game the way they want it. And it's always a way to shut down debate because we tend to be fascinated by the power of the computer. We have it on our smartphones, and we tend to go along with it. And we're kind of browbeaten, aren't we? On our side of the fence, we're more the applied science part of the equation, aren't we? We like to go out in the field. Empirical evidence is what we like, empirical from nature. And we tend to look for things that we can see in front of our eyes. But with computer models, it's a hidden secret science, isn't it? Secret science. The algorithms are rigged. The coding is kept secret. And they never reveal how they come up with the numbers. And again, we go back to the proxy data. As you said, Joe Olson, quite rightly, you know, the use of Michael Mann of using these bristlecone pines and things, it's, you know, they cherry-pick the data. And they're very persuasive when they're speaking. You must have seen this yourself over the years. You know, those who speak the loudest with the most powerful persuasive arguments with the biggest funding, they tend to win the day, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely do. I'm really amazed at some of the things, that some of the shenanigans that go on in this entire field. I'm shocked and awed by some of this stuff. For example, Michael Mann, I believe it's true to this day, he says, you can have my data, but you can't have the ways in which I've processed that data. And I remember posing this to my class. I said, is that important? They go, well, no, the data is the most important thing. How you process it is really relevant. I said, okay, let's take a database consisting of two numbers, 6 and 2. That's our database. We have two numbers. What happens if we add 6 and 2? And they say, well, we get 8, right? What happens if we subtract 2 from 6? Well, then we get 4. What happens if we multiply 6 times 2? Well, then we get 12. What happens if we divide 6 by 2? Well, then we get 3. 4 different answers using the exact same data. We've just applied 4 different operators to that data. How you process that data, quote unquote, is the key factor. So we can fudge the processes, and we're now finding out we can also fudge the data. There was an interesting comment by somebody at the Climate Research Unit over in Great Britain, who was given the task of reworking some of the code for these models. And it contains something like 1.2 million lines of code. Nobody can master 1.2 million lines of computer code. No one person can do this. And this one poor programmer who got this assignment said, okay, I followed the first couple of thousand lines. Now for the next 1,000 lines, what magic numbers do we punch in for that? He couldn't make the connections between different parts of the model because the models were that complex. When I was working at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, there was a gentleman there who was simulating climate over an 18,000 year period in 5-minute intervals for 12 different layers of the atmosphere. He must have had 20,000 computer cards there. And one day he came in and the whole stack was knocked over, and I thought he was going to lose his mind. And it's just an absurd idea that we can model something that complex with so many uncertainties. I just think it's an absurd task. We need to get back to basic empirical stuff and try to figure out what's going on in the first place. We need to get back to first principles. Models are not science. Models are our thought of what a system is. It's not what the system really is.
Yeah, well said. And you refer to the Harry Readme file, going back to 2009, the ClimateGate files. They were the mainstream media say they were hacked. They were actually released because the speed at which they were released couldn't be a hack. It had to be somebody from within the server itself to release the data. And the point is that Harry, the obviously a pseudonym by the person who did the coding, he got two large collections of data on a Unix and Unix-like system. And he had to kind of cobble it together and try and make sense of it. And when you look at these emails, it just shows a shocking amount of gerrymandering and botching. And this is something that maybe we'll get back into in the last part of the show after the break. This is TNT Radio.
President Biden warns we're all damned unless we follow his green policies.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
President Joe Biden gave his climate views, appropriately enough, on the Comedy Channel. Here is a portion of the interview.
If we don't keep the temperature from going above 1.5 degrees Celsius raised, then we're in real trouble. That whole generation is damned. I mean, that's not hyperbole.
First off, that is hyperbole. Second off, no one is damned. The only way we are damned is if we follow the climate agenda and shut down modern society to do absolutely nothing for the climate. Second, the temperature goal of 1.5 C or 2 degrees C were revealed in the ClimateGate emails to be, quote, pulled out of thin air and with no scientific basis. It was called clearly a, quote, political goal. Dr. Roger Pilkey Jr. said it's more grounded in political aspirations than science, and there's essentially no science behind these temperature goals. Yet, we will face the wrath of Mother Nature if we don't follow. Let's end medieval superstition and return to science. Reject the net zero climate agenda. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Today, Julian Assange is a political prisoner while the mainstream media stays silent. Why did Julian Assange land in a London jail? Julian's statement in October 2011 may provide a clue.
Why is it that banks have so much to hide? Why is it that banks, even more than military and intelligence organizations, have attacked WikiLeaks? Because banks are all about secrecy. Banks are all about asset hiding. Hiding the ill-gotten gains of rich individuals from around the world, stashing them in the Cayman Islands, other offshore jurisdictions, and yes, in London, number one censor of the British press.
If you're talking about it,
a poem, one today, says, and always one moon, like a silent drum tapping at every rooftop and every window on every of every county, countries. Let me start this over again.
We're talking about it. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hi, welcome back. We're talking about climate change and theories and junk science and corruption. And, we're lucky to have with us a former UN climate scientist. He was there at the beginning. He wrote in the first UN climate report way back in 1992. Professor Art Vittoretto, you mentioned the Harry Readme files, the ClimateGate, thousands of emails, and that was the key. The Harry Readme files released from the University of East Anglia were so revealing, and we've got that in the public domain now, and people can read it. They can actually go and look at it themselves. And Harry was a programmer. We made analysts have looked at these emails and made the connection that Harry was a very adept programmer who came in late in the day to try and make sense of all the data that they had from collected around the world from these climate research units and basically meteorological data. And they were fudging it so badly that this poor Harry guy was despairing. And one of the emails said he temporarily abandoned it. I quote, "I'm getting closer, but there's always another problem to be evaded. Instead, we'll try using some other program. This will include non-land cells and so forth." And he goes on and says, "Had a hunt and found an identically named temperature database file, which did include normal lines at the start of every station. How handy, naming two different files with exactly the same name and relying on their locations to differentiate." And what he'd done there, he spotted that the recording, the actual data recording, the basic clerical work was a botch. They weren't even, I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of temperature readings. And this poor guy, Harry, working in Norwich, Norwich is in East Anglia in England. He just couldn't get his head around it. And he presses on. He said he tried to debug the temperature data, and it was a useless task. In the end, he gave up. And the emails actually fizzle out. And he agreed that he said that from 1991 to 1995, they need to stay with the published data. What they'd done with it was a botch. And this is the state of climate science in government. And a lot of people have told me that government work is what you pay for. I mean, you, like me, you probably go back. You remember very well the 2009 ClimateGate episode. It was a travesty. It's what really brought me into the debate. At the time I was teaching in schools, in high schools in England, teaching the idea that the greenhouse gas theory was valid. I at the time was going along with it. And, you know, I think that was a turning point for me. Can you give us an idea of when you had your eureka moment, when you realized that the whole idea of government climate science was basically a Ponzi scheme, a fraud?
The inconvenient truth was that was the real game changer for me. When I saw that, I said, wow, wait a minute. I've heard these kinds of catastrophic prognostications my entire career. Now we've got to really go at this. So this is back in 2007. I started to question all this back in the 90s when I started to see the contamination of the urban databases. Now, by the way, I understand in the CRU, the Hadley Research Center over there, that they were Harry Reidme was finding temperature data up in the 90s in Siberia in January, and I think that's what that was the thing that alerted him to the fact that the data was totally fabricated. But yeah, I would say that the inconvenient truth really got to me. I said, you know, this is really, really wrong. So what I did is I convinced my college to have a screening of the film. And I debated the head of the environmental science department on the content of it, because we had both seen it. We says, fine, look it up there. It will present something to the community at large. We had a great turnout. About 150 people showed up for this. We showed the movie. We got up there and we had our debate. And all my opposition kept saying is, the science is settled. The science is settled. And finally, I opened up with, by the way, folks, questioning science is science. Science is never settled. Once the science is settled, then you know that the scientific process has stopped working. So that was sort of my Mendoza line, as we say here, as it refers to baseball. It's like, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm going to sit there and sort of actively research this, because I think that there is a lot of dishonesty. There's a lot of money and a lot of power in all of this. And when you start fear-mongering like that, you end up, let's face it, a fearful populace is an obedient populace. And I saw this happening. Now they're saying something like 30% of all youth today, school-aged kids, are depressed at the idea of climate change. I encountered a number of those students in my teaching. These are people who would literally, they said they'd lose sleep over it, they had nightmares over it, that it was affecting their relationships and their ability to really focus and enjoy life. I said, don't worry about it. It's absolutely ridiculous. So once you get a population afraid of something, they tend to be a lot more obedient.
Yeah, very well said. And inconvenient truth. Let's talk about inconvenient truth. Hold on. Just for context, Inconvenient Truth was a documentary. It won awards. And the guy who was behind it, Al Gore, as anybody who knows the history, he was vice president of the US under Bill Clinton. He lost the election against George Bush, and he then decided to become a global campaigner, a martyr for the green movement. And his film, Inconvenient Truth, I'll tell you from the perspective of myself, a school teacher at the time in 2007, we had to teach this crap in schools. And we had to show Al Gore's film and put it out there to our kids as if it was gospel, if it was hardcore truth. Lo and behold, a couple of years later, activists took the thing to court, said, we're not teaching this crap anymore. And guess what? The British High Court ruled that nine lies in the film, and told us that it could not be shown in British schools anymore unless there was a kind of warning. And guess what? That warning was never issued by me or any other teacher at the time. We had to continue with the lie, peddling the lie that Al Gore made many, many millions. I mean, man, what's he worth now? Over 100 million? The guy was a crook. And as you know, Al Gore, another man, Barack Obama, what did he do? Came out of office after all those years of preaching the story about climate change. He bought a lovely seaside apartment, a seaside property in Martha's Vineyard. Joe Olson, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Please make your point.
Oh, yeah. The reason we're having this discussion with Arthur today is because I'm a free range Texan, and I went and spent my own money, over $2,000, to go to Las Vegas for that convention and got a chance to talk to him and really discuss this and encourage him to get his material printed and to continue doing his research. And he's done a great job. But I just want to give you a heads up on what I've got this next week. There's a meeting on Wednesday with Scott Ritter that I'm signed up to go attend. There's a meeting on Saturday with Del Bigtree, who I've met at a half dozen different rallies, maybe a dozen, and talked to him. And then Mickey Willis, who's the producer of the Plandemic movies. I had dinner with him in September of last year in Austin. He'll be there. And surprise, surprise, Jim Gale, the guy that I'm going to have the Food Forest fist fight with, is going to be one of the speakers there. Oh, so we'll be broadcasting next Saturday from a live event. And then on Sunday, Richard Gage, the founder of Architects and Engineers for 911 Truth, who I've met at three different events and had dinner with twice, is going to be at another event. And so maybe we can drag some of these folks in and have some more interesting TNT conversations as time goes on, because we've got a lot bigger problems than just the climate problem. And that's what PSI has focused on, is doing the full spectrum science and history to tell the truth as good as we possibly can, and to inform as many people as we can. And I have to admit that we've been highly successful in that venture.
Yeah, Art Vitoretto, you've been with us. I mean, I recall that 2018 was when I really latched onto your ideas, and I wrote about it on Principia Scientific. You know, that's been read many thousands of times around the world. It's a global movement for truth. And, you know, we're not always claiming to be right. We like to have the debate. And the point is, we get out there in the public domain and talk about these ideas. And, you know, today we're putting on the radio internationally your ideas. Some people will disagree. As you say, the Heartland Institute, you've got your friends there, and you've got people who are against you. And it's the way science is done, isn't it? The right way to do science is to debate it, get it out in the public domain, shine the light of day on it, and see what comes of it. And, you know, Do you think that's the way forward? I mean, do you like the idea of getting away from secret science? I mean, you from your own career, do you think it's too much a old boys network and too much stuff done behind closed doors?
Way too much old boys network. There's no doubt about it. It's Joe talks about peer review as pal review. And that's what happens in a lot of the journals, is that you'll go out and rustle up a bunch of friends and get them to evaluate your article and have it published. And it becomes that you get these very, very closed, tight circles of folks controlling the flow of information. I mean, most of the information comes through literally a handful of journals to the professional world. And this includes, for example, the Journal of Climate, Climatic Change. The Journal of Climate and the Climatic Change put out something like 15,000 pages of material every year, just those two journals. Journal of Geophysical Research is another big one. But again, it's nearly impossible to get published in those journals unless you are spouting the official party line on this. If you're not talking the canon, then they don't want to talk to you. And I found that very discouraging. Of course, there are open access publishers now that will publish this material, and you get a peer review process. So I'm happy to publish in that realm, but then you get, well, that's not top-notch peer review, and blah, blah, blah. You hear all that nonsense. And it's like, well, wait a minute. At some point, where else are we supposed to go with this stuff? And they basically, their attitude is just, you know, sit down and shut up. I first presented this at a regional meeting at the Association of American Geographers. It was called the Mid-Atlantic Division of the AHA. And I got up and presented, and a bunch of eyeballs popped out of people's heads and said, where'd you come up with this stuff? I said, well, here's the data. Here's how you can work with the data. Here's how you can work. No, I'll happily answer any questions. On the during the luncheon, one of the graduate students came up to me and started talking to me. And I gave her my card, call me, whatever. I'll be happy to work with you on your thesis. She was a master's student. And after we broke out into a sort of like a meet and greet session, I noticed one of her professors pulled her aside. I couldn't help but overhear this. Don't talk to that guy. He's nuts. And she's looking over to me. And so her advisor was actively telling her, do not talk to me. This is going to pollute your thinking. You don't want to go in this place. This is not a good place for you to be. So this is how this thing sort of operates. It's very, very ugly. We have corrupted the free flow of information. What I find so amusing, though, as if you look at some of the icons of this movement, yeah, there's people like Al Gore, but now that the latest superstar is Greta Thunberg, she just got an honorary doctorate, I understand.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which is
and theology.
I think she's a high school dropout. And interestingly, the first person who brought attention to this fact of the CO2 is going to create lots of problems. Or it was going to change the climate of the Earth was a gentleman named Svante Arrhenius, and right. He predicted that any doubling was going to raise the temperature by, he made some predictions about 4 degrees and 8 degrees. But he also went on to say that, oh, this is actually a good thing for the planet because places like Canada and Russia are going to have a lot of, you know, agricultural productivity. What people don't know is that Greta Thunberg is actually the great, great, great niece of Svante Arrhenius. So yeah. It's kind of a family business, too.
It very much is. And I'd like to go back to the point that I made earlier about Max Planck, that famous quote, you know, science advancing one funeral at a time. Believe it or not, there was a study done in 2019 published by the American Economic Review that found that to be true. I found it quite amazing because I was looking into this earlier. And believe it or not, it's a very tight-knit community. And studies authors found that when a leading scientist, an innovator, you know, somebody who's at the vanguard dies, all of a sudden those who were in the shade, they come to the fore again and they get more of a chance to publish. So what happens is you've got the idea of the superstar in science. And I'm thinking back to people like Stephen Hawking. You know, he carried the can, he carried the torch, I should say, for Einsteinian physics, and that went very well. And he passed away, and lo and behold, we're now beginning to have more of a debate about the idea of the steady state universe. And that's again, that wouldn't have happened if Stephen Hawking was alive today. And it's the kind of thing that I'm aware of, and Joe Olson, you were aware of, and Joe Posmer, you are too. It seems to be the case that science can only progress when key figures step aside. And I noticed when James Hansen, we talked about James Hansen earlier, the head honcho at the NASA's GIS, you know, the top climate scientist in America, he made a lot of money doing what he did. And as you rightly pointed out, Art, you know, he chopped and changed what he was saying through his career. And I remember when I first looked at his work, he was talking about dust, not CO2, dust being a key factor in changing the climate. It just goes to show that personalities control science. It's not what we think, is it, Art? It's all down to who has the biggest mouth, the biggest wallet, the biggest funding. And, you know, people are duped by it, aren't they?
And the Arrhenius hypothesis was in 1895. We have a great article that we posted at Principia Scientific. What is the Stokes shift? December 4th, 2022. And George Gabriel Stokes verified that anything it absorbs emits a longer wavelength, lower energy, which means that it can do nothing other than cool. Anything that absorbs. And that's what we had in our book in 2010. And he made this presentation to the Royal Society of London in 1852. So they have to overlook 50 years of proven science that anything that absorbs is cooling. And in order to be able to come up with this phony baloney hypothesis that's been proved wrong every way possible. It's absolutely crazy that we have to deal with this.
Well,
I've always said follow the science means follow the money. And because the money, there's a lot of money. Talk about the climate industry, they estimate that on climate research, something like the last number I saw on this is something like $12 billion went into climate science research. And that's a lot of money. And a very small group of people on the inside have captured, I would say, the lion's share of that money.
Yeah, Professor Art Vittorito, it's been wonderful having you on Sky Dragon Slaying. You're shining light on the truth. It's hopefully we'll have you back again. Keep submitting and publishing with Principia Scientific, and you know, wish you well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. It was a real pleasure. I enjoyed it.